Illusions Patches. In honor of the incredible Burt Wonderstone, what's your favorite comedy featuring a niche career?
I'm Katie Rich, and I would love to see a concert by John Candy's Polka Band in Home Alone.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and though an argument could be made for Dirty Work, I'm going to have to stick with Jim Carrey and go with Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
I'm Matt Patches, and I guess there's been a lot of golf movies in the past 30-some years, but I'm going to go with Caddyshack because that seems ultra-specific to the weird world of caddying.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I don't entirely understand this question, so I'm just going to say Zoolander, which is my response in most situations where I'm confused.
There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
This week on Operation Kino, episode 105 for the week of Friday, March 15th, 2013.
But I don't think there's been an experience I've had that quite matches the free-form aspects of storytelling involved with playing Dungeons & Dragons.
And they take the money and they go to spring break where they meet a cornrowed drug dealer slash gun runner named Alien, who is played by James Franco, who's in the middle of a turf war with his childhood friend, who's another person in a similar position, who's played by Gucci Mane, the rapper. And it's sort of about the shenanigans that they all get into down there.
Basically, what I'm just going to say is put blank into blank and into blank.
That sounds appropriate.
Okay, we could use put.
Why has visual effects happened this way as opposed to other elements of production that are done as a bidding basis? Which I believe, I mean, you can do this for, like, transportation. And, like, there's not everything is set up as a part and parcel with the studio. So, like, why did this happen?
Well, a lot of those are unions. I mean,
yeah, they are. The Transpo Union is probably one of the most powerful unions in Hollywood.
Okay, so Katie, hold on tight, because we're about to get little nerdy here, I guess.
I'm not ready for this.
Are you ready for this?
Zero charisma?
Oh, God, we'll get there, too.
I think this is going to be like that episode of Freaks and Geeks where James Franco plays Dungeons and Dragons with the geeks, right?
Way to steal my thunder about what I'm talking about.
Yes,
I'm talking about Dungeons and Dragons here, and I'm guessing that most people have a very short-sighted understanding of Dungeons and Dragons. I certainly did too before playing a few weeks ago for the first time. I don't watch Community, but I'm aware that there is a big episode of Community about Dungeons and Dragons, and that seems to be people's extent of the game. Am I wrong with that assumption? Katie?
I think most of the people who watch Community also play Dungeons and Dragons, or at least are familiar. I knew enough about Dungeons and Dragons to understand that Community episode.
Fair enough. And exactly. I think most people have an understanding. You can picture the Dungeon Master. You can picture his cardboard cutout thing with all the data on it. You can picture people rolling D20 dice.
I mean, I think from the beginning,
challenging.
It was, you know, people understood it as sort of a synonym for nerdiness more
exactly.
than anything else.
But nerd has become such the nerd world has become so common, and like everyone's gotten into so many different things. Dungeons and Dragons, though, seems still to be an outlier in the mainstream. We can throw it around, but we don't really have an understanding of it. So I was obviously cautious about entering this world because I'm the type of personality who can get really absorbed into things rather quickly, and I'm a dedicated soldier to the games I play. I was brought into Dungeons & Dragons through a group of my friends who have been playing it for a little while and just tried to explain it to me as a group gathering based on storytelling, which really intrigued me as someone who has done like improv comedy and loves the moth storytelling. And I love storytelling and I love geeky fantasy. So it seems logical for me to play Dungeons & Dragons if that's the actual conceit. And I'm shocked to say that it really is. It was an amazing 8-hour experience playing Dungeons & Dragons for the first time and very much about oral storytelling and sitting around with a group of my friends crafting an adventure.
What did you do? Well, that might be a good way to explain.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was introduced by my dungeon master into this world that is not like your typical maybe Games of Thrones-ish Lord of the Rings fantasy. This was more like City of Ember. And this guy who runs the game, seriously, I know, this guy had spent hours and hours crafting a story for us to play through with history and backstory and rooms that we would be traveling through, and every little detail he had to figure out. There would be problems to solve and objects to find and creatures to encounter. And as we're trying to solve the big picture of this world, which, as I said, is something like City of Embers, and we're trying to get back to the top of this mountain that our people have been living in for hundreds of years, and it's finally time to reemerge, and we're going to kind of battle our way through puzzles and creature encounters. And it was so detailed. And basically, he presents it with no limitations. You know, you enter this room and tell me what you see, or tell me what you're going to do, and I'll tell you what you find. And then you tell me how you want to encounter it. And, you know, on this podcast, we've talked a lot about the way we experience movies and the way certain other mediums challenge our ways of telling stories and encountering them and digesting them. We talk about video games every once in a while, reading books and that sort of thing. But I don't think there's been an experience I've had that quite matches the free-form aspects of storytelling involved with playing Dungeons & Dragons and really sitting there talking about, okay, my character is a 70-year-old man who used to battle in the old wars, and now he's a loner who's decided to join the clan, and he has chains on his hands, and that's what he whips people with chains, or maybe he can lower you into a cavern of some sort. I can do anything, and it was so refreshing, creatively speaking, to be able to play in this world. And I turn it on you guys because I'm sure, well, maybe Dave. Dave seems to have some understanding of Dungeons & Dragons and may have dipped his toes into it. But to storytell in this kind of freeform arena, I'm not sure I've had an experience like it, or from this description, if you guys have ever had anything like that before.
I mean, I've played Dungeons & Dragons once upon a time.
Oh,
but,
there you go.
You know, we're talking I guess 15 years ago now. And I remember enjoying the experience very much, especially because it was, you know, we played it in a windowless room in one of my friend's basements, and it was like being entirely sealed away from reality in a way that some other forms of entertainment are not quite so immersive. But listening to you talk about how much you enjoyed this particular game, I was just like, well, then why can't we have good movies? Like, if it's so easy for some dungeon master, which is still difficult for me to say, because I just immediately, my mind brings me to, like, you know, BDSM places. But if it's so easy.
Well, it's also involved that, too. I was chained and being choked by this man, and I got an erection.
It was a Saturday for you, so you know, as expected. But if a dungeon master, some guy who, you know, presumably is not involved in storytelling professionally, I mean, I'm just, you know, I think a lot of these people are not, even if this one was. If he's able to create such an immersive environment for you and a compelling narrative, why are we stuck with such shitty movies?
It's interesting. I just wanted to respond to that really quickly, because I asked him the same question, basically. Like, if you're going to if you're going to craft something so detailed and so rich, why would you limit yourself to making it a Dungeons & Dragons game? You could write a book. You could write a script with this story. And he kind of countered me by saying, No one would appreciate it. The amount of people who could appreciate it are the people sitting in this room, and that's why they're playing it. And I feel that way about a lot of movies, especially, you know, we don't get original fantasy. We don't really get a lot of original sci-fi, because to make it so textured, you'd have to make it specific enough to turn a lot of people away, and you can't really do that anymore.
I think that's a misnomer. I think the reason that you could create a great Dungeons & Dragons game is the same reason that you could, you know, make a great Prince of Persia game but not make a good Prince of Persia movie, which is that these are things that are based around a core mechanic in Dungeons & Dragons. It's a set of rules and how you, you know, combat, and it's stuff that's all running in the Dungeons Master's head but not in the people experiencing the story. Whereas also with, like, a video game, there's, like, a new first-person heads-up display, or you could rewind time or what have you. And these are all things that become really beneficial and enhance the story to someone playing it. But if you were to step back and tell that story, you lose that interactive element. It's, like, sort of the story that you described your dungeon master telling is the story of the dwarves and the hobbit. Your guy just had chains and you had fun because you didn't encounter the Goblin King and had Gandalf and all that sort of thing. But it's essentially the same structure and outline. And what makes a good dungeon master is stuff that is more along the lines of making a good game, which is you can predict sort of how encounters can go and sort of plan for all the different options out of it. So that he had to have those histories and those things because you might stumble across them, whereas I'm sure he also had things that you guys didn't happen across that he already had like planned out in his head. But it's not like linear storytelling. Like, in a lot of ways, when you're talking about making movies and fantasy and sci-fi, they're hampered because in order to be accepted by like the main audience, you're basically doing like a hero's journey or, you know, X amount of structures, and you're playing with like sort of these base characters because you can't have 8-hour interactions with it. Was that too summation?
It just sounds to me like these are stories that you're going to enjoy because you're involved in them, because it can be long, because it can be all of these different things that they are not going to be in any other medium, which it was what makes these games so fun, I imagine.
Well, to kind of counter what Dave was saying, I do think that these are the type of stories. I mean, you can build worlds this rich and have them feel worn in and make them feel interactive to an audience. I think you can do that in a movie. I know not to the extent of playing a game of Dungeons and Dragons where I can, you know, walk around an environment or I can blow up the ceiling and see what falls through and see how that impacts my journey. And it's obviously not the same level of interaction, but it does feel like you could take cues from how Dungeons and Dragons operates and apply it to other forms of storytelling.
You need to watch that Community episode, I think, is what we're all learning.
What did they say? What is that episode about? I actually have never seen it.
They leave out most of the mechanics. Sorry, go ahead, Katie.
Well, yeah, it's more about like group building, and it's more about them agreeing to help out this guy who wants to play the game. I think maybe that's why it was accessible to me. It wasn't as much about the mechanics. It's just like getting dice rolls and doing things for the sake of other people in your group.
It's close, but it leaves out a lot of the charm of like a dungeon and dungeoneering and all that. That doesn't really
dungeoneering.
Dungeoneering.
On that, those like extremely nerdy lineers. Terminology.
The dungeoneers.
The dungeoneers.
I love them, man. Going to be talking about Spring Breakers for the next 10 minutes. Spring Break forever. And we're going to hope that this doesn't just devolve into quoting James Franco from the movie, although I think it's somewhat inevitable that it will, and that's okay too.
I think that's the most effective way to review the movie.
It really is. I mean, and we'll get to the fact that I think the movie is very deliberately hypnotic, but for the zero of you out there who don't know what Spring Breakers is, it is Harmony Korine's new film. Harmony Korine not is necessarily known for making films with such a broad appeal to movie fans of all kind.
Didn't Julian Donkey Boy make like $100 million?
Oh yeah, no, it was
domestic box office.
It was a four quadrant hit.
Oh right, okay.
Story, yeah, the Dogma 95 Rule Breaker starring Werner Herzog. Yeah, that was a blockbuster.
Huge.
There's no subconscious Freudian slip where bra makes sense with Harmony Korine, I don't think. I think we most recently saw him making a film about those rappers from South Africa. There was a short film that Patrick and I saw.
Die Antwoord?
Die Antwoord, yeah. Jimmy Wan. I don't know. I have the song and the mantra from that movie stuck in my head for years, even though I've forgotten everything else that has to do with it. But Spring Breakers is becoming quite a little bit of a phenomenon because what it is Harmony Korine at his stab for and at the mainstream has taken a couple.
Is it?
Well, we'll get there. Has taken a couple nubile young starlets, very recognizable girls. You have Selena Gomez, who needs no introduction, I'm sure. You have Ashley Benson, aka the one who is mind-numbingly attractive, and I think dating James Franco in real life, but I think if I can gather from interviews, maybe not the most pleasant individual. I don't know. I'm reaching. But she's from Pretty Little Liars, so I hold a grudge against her because her show is probably going to get Bunheads canceled. That's neither here nor there. And then there's Vanessa Hudgens, And finally, rounding out the cast is the least well-known among them, is Harmony Korine's wife, Rachel. And they are four scantily clad girls who share a dream of getting out of their shitty wherever college, some community school in the middle of nowhere, and going to spring break in Florida. And they, some of the girls at least, except for Faith, who's played by Selena Gomez, is very religiously minded and ostensibly virtuous. Her name is Faith, yes. And we meet her in the middle of a religious meeting at her school to hammer that home. Rob a chicken shack, of all places, because everyone knows that chicken shacks are the
rolling
most lucrative places to rob.
That's where the cash at.
And they take the money, and they go to spring break, where they meet a corn road drug dealer slash gun runner named Alien, who is played by James Franco, who's in the middle of a turf war with his childhood friend, who's another person in a similar position, who's played by Gucci Mane, the rapper. And it's sort of about the shenanigans that they all get into down there. It is completely insane. It is a...
not a whole lot happens.
Not a whole lot happens in the movie, as some of the girls find that they aren't particularly enamored by Alien, and one by one, sort of like it's a reality show, get eliminated and head home.
Why don't they love his shit and hats and guns?
Some of them are his motherfucking soulmates. There's an incredible scene where there's like a quasi, I'd say it's like it transcends rudimentary sexual intercourse scene between James Franco's character and two of the girls involving him performing fellatio on a loaded gun, and it ends in amazing declarations of love. It's incredible. Anyway,
David, let me grab you by the collar here and tell. I demand to know why you think this movie works, because I am with you in loving the hell out of it. But I think from the outside, the joke is not going to land with everyone, or what makes it so hypnotic is not going to work for everybody.
I think what you have to understand is when you may listen to my description of the film, you may think like you've seen this movie before, that it feels like another teen-filled, sex-fueled romp, and it is very much not that. Harmony Korine is not a filmmaker, if you have familiarity with his work, if you've seen Gummo or Julian Donkey Boy or anything like that, you know that he doesn't really toe the party line. Everything that he makes is very much its own thing. And this is no exception to that, despite its veneer of being a little bit more mainstream. I mean, it is – the movie unfurls sort of like a mantra. I mean, it's very – it repeats certain sections over and over and over again. There are – throughout the entire film, the thing that you'll hear everybody whispering when they're like, spring break, is just whispered into the soundtrack. Like it's – you know, barely liminal. It's a movie that obviously has a lot on its mind beyond simply just showing scantily clad bodies. Its opening scene, where it has this great mix between Cliff Martinez, who did the music for Drive, and Skrillex, the reigning king of dubstep, have created the score together. And the movie just opens with this bombardment of spring break footage. It's like the NC-17 version of the MTV's old spring break footage with just
there are some
people.
Boobs.
Yeah,
boobs
it's
in
like
this movie.
Oh, NC-17 is pushing it, I'd definitely say. It's an R look at spring break. You have slow motion, like Bacchanalia, Caligula style boobs and boobs.
But do you think it's ends up being critical of that, and that's why it works?
Loving,
that it's some sort of lampoon of that? Because I'm wondering where that iconography,
right,
in some ways, those images that we recognize from other movies, and then this kind of like tone poem approach to presenting them kind of collide and comment.
You know, speaking of tone poem, I think I described after the movie that it was like a Kesha video directed by Terrence Malick.
Sure.
It's really how it feels. And I think that the movie wouldn't work if it were outright polemic, if it were really just raging at these things and really forcing us to cast a critical eye at the behavior that we, and the culture we create and the behavior that we instill in our children.
And idealize.
Exactly. The movie wouldn't have worked in that way. It would have been way too simple. And so I think while this movie is critical of everything, not the least of which, I mean, capitalism as a whole, the certain idea of a carnal capital and just like the way that bodies and figure into a sort of economy of their own, and how this culture is perpetuated or not. I mean, all these things are – it's so in love with its own story. It's so it's so supportive of its and empowering in a way of its girls. I mean, I think if it were a polemic, if it were saying like this is all wrong, it would be really it would be saying that these girls are stupid and that they don't have the capacity to think for themselves and have their own agency and consider their roles in all of this. But it, the movie is quite the opposite, and the girls are endowed with an agency that is unlike almost any other film, I assure you, that any of these people have ever been in.
I have a quick question. Yeah. Katie, you saw this at Toronto. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that, I mean, about how it presents the female characters and, like, do you feel like they're empowered in that way?
I think some of them are. I think it's a little, it's slippery because some of the girls kind of buy into this lifestyle and some of them don't. Selena Gomez is not in nearly as much of the movie as everybody else is. And I think it's weird and I think it's, you know, controversial and out there and not at all like a role model of what people should be doing. But I do think, I mean, the sight of these girls in their fluorescent bikinis and their, you know, hostage hockey
masks. There's a Pussy Riot thing
going
on.
Weapons. It's very, I mean, it's really confrontational and it kind of contrasts with what you see in the beginning where there's these endless slow motion shots of like girls having like beer poured on their breasts and like really commodified and like these guys are just kind of like looking them and using them as objects, and at the end they're in this really different position. But I don't know if it's as blatant a message as you're making it sound.
They do get to retaliate against those guys in some way by being empowered and being able to stick a gun in their face and like suck tequila out of my belly button, but I will also put a pistol in your nose and make you pee yourself. They end up having a wake up call at some point.
I mean, I think sell it, you know, too much one way or the other. I definitely don't think it is entirely this like female empowering, all gung ho, you know, type of film. I think that it's much more interested in just the dynamic between all of these things and sort of the buying and selling of and the leveraging of power. As it informs sexuality and the need for this sort of experience, I think it's very much just sort of engaged with the dialogue between all of these things rather than sort of coming down one way or the other. I mean, I think that the way the movie ends, which I, you know, would not reveal here, I think is makes it very clear that Harmony Korine is not trying to shove a particular worldview down anybody's throats. I think he's just taken this one particular sliver of America, which he believes to be a rite of passage, I mean, a legitimate one. He said in an interview that I was reading recently, I believe in the New York Times, that he would encourage his daughter, who he had recently, to go on this when she's of age because it's a rite of passage of some kind. But
David?
Yeah.
David, look at my shit.
Yes. But I think it's not.
Does he have shorts or shirts in every color? I can't remember.
He has shorts.
But I don't think it's as simple as one way or the other. I think the movie really makes it clear that he's just taking this experience and jacking it up to 111, and letting you sort of sort through the chaos.
It's time for Film Centipede. Like a human centipede, but with films. We've sewn three films together, to mouth, to see what other film gets shit out at the end. For example, James Cameron's 2009 film Avatar would be produced by Robert Zemeckis' A Christmas Carol, shitting into Fern Gully, shitting into Pocahontas. Got it? Well then, let's play Film Centipede.
Okay, I came up with a bunch of Film Centipede options. It's really hard to do this and have a sense of how difficult or easy they are, so I'm hoping these are not impossible.
Bring it on.
And not too obvious. So I'm just going to do as many as I can in this limited amount of time. So we're going to start with put The Dark Knight into Straw Dogs into The Bourne Supremacy.
I'm gonna say that's Skyfall.
That is indeed
Ooh.
Skyfall.
Ooh, nice.
The Straw Dogs,
right.
I think. Gave it away.
Yeah.
Okay. My brain didn't entirely adjust to what we're doing now.
You gotta live.
Let's try one that's apropos to our Spring Breakers conversation.
Is it Spring Breakers?
No.
Okay.
Put High School Musical into This Is 40 into Big.
My 17 going, what the fuck? You know, that movie was that
17 again.
Yeah,
yeah,
it is.
Go.
Oh, nice.
Teamwork.
Okay, all right, so those are doable. That's good to know. How about this one? Lawrence of Arabia into Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants into Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Whoa. First off, I just want to see a sequel to Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants that's Lawrence of Arabia, exactly.
That's special. I mean, that Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, too,
the
is not really
enough. The pants that saved.
So they go to the Middle East. Some young girls go to the Middle East.
And there's...
And then the pants just, without a person, take over the entire Middle East. right?
I think you guys are ignoring the whatever happened to Baby Jane version of this.
Why? Yes. Okay.
Would you like a hint?
Sure.
Need a hint.
This movie is a sequel.
Oh my gosh.
It is a sequel.
Tell us.
David has also quoted it on the show in the past.
Oh my god. David? Huh? He quotes a lot of things. And not often
really
in
help.
Context.
Just the way that he said it is, it's stuck in my brain for eternity.
I don't know. Give it to us. What is it?
You ready? It is Sex and the City 2.
Oh, right. Oh. They go to Dubai.
Lawrence,
yes,
David, do you want to say the line that I'm remembering?
Lawrence of my labia. Right?
Yep, that's exactly what it was. It is truly terrifying.
I mean, it's the only line from Sex and the City 2 that I know and will stay with me until I die, so...
All right, this is a slightly easier one, I think. The Object of My Affection, into Martha Marcy May Marlene, into Wet Hot American Summer.
The Shape of Things?
No.
No, that's
that would
way
be
out of left field, but I feel like that works, right?
You can reuse that one later when you do it.
Okay, sounds good.
Martha Marcy May Marlene. So it's probably a camp movie. Cults, a camp.
Oh, Wanderlust. No?
Yeah.
Oh, Wanderlust.
Great film.
The Object of My Affection also starred Jennifer
Very
Aniston
funny
and
movie.
Paul Rudd. Yeah. What do you guys think?
One more?
Sure. Yeah, we could do it.
Okay. Let's do Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, into Avatar, into Open Water.
Wow.
Life of Pi.
Oh.
Yeah, it is.
Oh.
Bravo.
All right.
I was just thinking like old people visit a new planet and...
No, I would see that movie. That's what the sequel should be. They should combine the sequels.
I think that's the sequel to Cocoon, old people visiting a new planet. That is the latest installment of Film Centipede with less graphic visual imagery.
Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed making it.
Mm-hmm.
Got money, I'll do anything for you. Got money, just tell me what you want me to. Got money, nail me up against the wall.
So I thought it would be apropos to spend this week talking about what's going on in the visual effects world. Specifically, it sort of gained attention after the Oscars and is going to have some more attention when you're listening to this, because March 14th, or Pi Day, is now a union up day for the visual effects department, where they're encouraging as many people as possible who consider themselves visual effects artists to get some sort of representation or join a union so they could start having some bargaining rights, which is all probably Greek without knowing what the actual crisis is. So basically,
a lot of people have been supporting it on Twitter and Tumblr, and it seems like a very easy thing to support without knowing anything about.
Yes, well, because everybody could sort of acknowledge that there are tons of visual effects in our movies these days, and that a lot of times they're the best part of it.
Life of Pi. Is Life of Pi chosen as a nod to Life of Pi, or the 14th?
Yes,
Pi
it
Day
was chosen as alive. And the Life of Pi has sort of been the cornerstone of where the movement's made its visual peak and the trades and what have you, because the company Rhythm and Hues that did Life of Pi is in the middle of bankruptcy as we speak, and I think there's a South Korean buyer that's looking to swoop in and take all of its assets and maybe none of its talent. So it's very contentious, and they were cut off during their Oscar speech by the theme to Jaws, unironically. Possibly ironically. Let's give the Oscar director some credit. Maybe he just played a really good joke. But basically what happened is in the early 80s, you began to make movies with computer graphics. And from what I understand, around 1992, 1993... you have some sort of big tentpole movies that use a lot of computer-generated imagery, and everybody realizes this could be a boon to filmmaking and storytelling, and it makes tentpoles possible because the whole basis of you could have a shark, stalking the ocean, or you could have a man flying and saving Lois Lane, now doesn't involve wires and mechanics that could break down or look cheesy because they don't adhere to physics. And so these companies start springing up that can do visual effects, or what we would now recognize as visual effects. And because they're sort of It comes up in sort of like a wild, wild west way where you have all these tech people as well as animators sort of meeting in this new technology. And because of that, they didn't form a union or like a single voice. Instead, you would just be able to find the person that was capable of doing that project, and they would, you know, bid you something. And so as there became to be more and more people capable of doing a project, they had to start outbidding each other or underbidding each other for jobs. So like I could do it for X amount, which is, you know, X amount more or less million than my competitors. And they started just throwing in other things to sweeten the deal where you would have a fixed amount or a fixed bid. And then no matter how many days or hours you went overtime, you would still get your visual effects delivered at that bid. And then the business started to sort of piling on top of each other as these sort of CGI tent poles became a major chunk of a cinema box office every year. And these companies kept underbidding each other. And then this thing started happening where states would individually say they would refund a percentage of your production cost if you did that production in their state. The idea being that you would then hire people in that state and it would be a boon to the state's economy. But instead, what started happening is you started getting things like states like Louisiana, where they don't have a cap, so the state can approve, you know, as many film productions as it wants, and will pay back, you know, a certain percentage of that film if it's done in Louisiana. So then you have all these production people going down to Louisiana, and all these movie stars, and the studio goes to the visual effects house and says, "Well, we need to be in Indiana or Louisiana. We're not going to get this break, so you have to go open up a shop in Louisiana." And what you have is these visual effects companies that are splitting. They were already not making much of a profit, maybe like 15% to 20%, and now they have to open new places and new states and have new artists. And the artists themselves can't stay in one place. They kind of have to go where the dollar is. And so as, you know, visual effects are being more and more bigger parts of movies, studios are looking for a way to do it cheaper. And the person that are losing out are these visual effects houses, which really have no way to collectively bargain at the moment and find a new rate.
Why has visual effects happened this way as opposed to other elements of production that are done as a bidding basis, which I believe, I mean, you can do this for like transportation and like there's not everything is set up as a part and parcel with the studio. So like why did this happen?
Well, a lot of those are unions. I mean,
yeah, they are. There's the transpo union is probably one of the most powerful unions in Hollywood.
So then why is there a visual effects union?
Well, I mean, it's like anything that has...
Because they don't travel, I think, is the issue here. Whereas you could take a production to Louisiana and make a movie, and there are production, there are transport people, there are camera people, there are all sorts of people there. But you don't really need to move your visual effects people around and your post-production people around the way you normally would. Which is confusing to me, Dave, because then why would they be part of the specific state deals?
Well, the unions have deals with studios. So if you're a union production, you're using that union regardless of where you're going. If you're a non-union, you know, production person, then it's like, so many things got filmed in North Carolina at that Wilmington studio, the Screen Gems studio, because Screen Gems already had, you know, a group of people that worked there full time. So you could bring your movie in and you already have some crew there, and you would only have to bring in certain people that you were contractually obligated to or the people that you chose. If there was no rules, you bring in the union people that you want, but then you were just looking for the cheapest option otherwise, and that's when stuff like VFX gets sort of tossed out. To answer Katie's question, it's really the process in which it developed. Like animation went through a similar thing, and even when animators formed a union, they still were at such a weak bargaining point because they'd formed it so late that like most animators still don't get residuals on what they do. So it's like, you know, you could draw Bugs Bunny for your entire life, but you'd only get the salary for the hours that you worked drawing Bugs Bunny, not for every time your cartoon plays on, you know, some rerun channel.
But how often do people get residuals from anything like that? I mean, like, to get residuals if you're an actor in a movie is difficult.
I mean, I'm not saying that visual effects should look towards residuals, because already that's something they got trapped in, which is why Life of Pi could, you know, do so well, but Rhythm and Hues could go out of business. It's because already they've started exchanging, you know, bits of their rate for bits of the cut of the movie, but that puts them in a horrible position because then they're operating at a loss with the hope that the movie's good, which they have only limited control over. I mean, and also the residual thing was more to talk about how animation unions formed like an imperfect union just because they diversified before unionizing, which is sort of the VFX problem.
So I think I told you before we started that I was, you know, kind of wanted to think of the libertarian devil's advocate point of view of this. I mean, why is this different from the car industry? Like, why are, like, they, you know, they're being outbid by other countries. These things are getting done elsewhere. Why do we need to save them? Why isn't this just a business problem that will work itself out the way the free market does?
I mean, I kind of think it is, which is why this is so, I think, difficult an issue. Because really what all the things that are going to happen are happening on the business side, which the public at large has no influence in. All we could do is provide, you know, acknowledgement that the visual effects artists are there. And that's something that, you know, if the animators had when they were negotiating their union terms, might have gotten them closer to getting residuals, because it's saying, we recognize that you're people who want pensions, and, you know, we recognize your work on these films and your contribution to it. So, I mean, I don't know if it is a lot like the auto union, but like the auto workers are unionized. So, you know, even if China is making, I mean, you're always going to have Weta providing, you know, non-United States top quality visual effects work. And so it's not like, I don't think that we're really looking at, you know, as much a problem with outsourcing as some people feel it is. It's more like interstate competitiveness with these film subsidies. And how projects are financed on the visual effects side.
But my question is, will Hollywood have to succumb to this? I mean, through your research and from the different protests that have been happening ever since this kind of emerged to the scene over the Oscars, I mean, is this something that they even have a chance to beat? Can they beat the system here, and will it impact the movies we watch? Because off the podcast, we were talking a little bit about the writers' union and their protests and, you know, trying to fight back against these people who don't want to pay anything to anyone.
But they were fighting for very specifically better terms in their union, and their contracts, which the visual effects industry hasn't even gotten that
right. And even that, I mean, that battle proved to have a ripple effect through what we experience as audiences to this whole thing. I'm wondering if the visual effects people have a case, if they can't have the leverage to be able to overcome the oppression they seem to be having from Hollywood, and if that battle for them will impact us as movie viewers.
Well, I mean, their only hope at this point. Oh, go ahead.
No,
David.
I was going to say, I mean, this is very much a devil's advocate position, and it's sort of a useless line of thought, I realize. But, like, you know, maybe 6 months where visual effects artists were unavailable to Hollywood studios would be to our benefit. You know, maybe I certainly have no interest in seeing these people out of work, losing money that they deserve. They are artists and craftsmen and deserve to be paid as such. And it's horrible what's happened to them. But at the same time, you know, maybe this situation, which will refocus Hollywood on how much they rely upon visual effects in order to complete any of their larger films, will make them realize that they might be better served by – this is totally naive thinking, because they would figure out another way to do this and just carry on what makes them money. But maybe they would be better served by making smaller films, or films that don't so heavily rely on computer-generated graphics. That won't happen.
That's the hardest thing about these kind of conversations about you know, real workers, tradesmen, craftsmen working in an artistic industry where, on one hand, like, do we need what they do? Could there be a cut back to what they do? But then, of course, they'd be losing out on the work. You know, for every giant Marvel movie that comes out, lots of people get employed. And hopefully, if the visual effects people have their way, lots of people will benefit from those movies. On the other hand, you know, if there's a pressure and there's a money issue, will they scale back? And do the people viewing movies actually win in the end? Which is a weird kind of warped point of view. But I'm just really interested if we'll see kind of a pullback the way that David's suggesting. Like, if the visual effects people aren't there because they're trying to protest, will we see a scale back in the kind of blockbusters that demand their talent?
I mean,
I think they'll get undercut by houses in China.
Exactly. I mean,
but no one wants to see like food fight quality.
Well, they wouldn't.
CG
I mean, they
animation.
Would. They pay. You know, the studios are willing to pay such and such a rate. They will get, you know, work at that level. They may not have access to the top tier, and their movies might suffer for that, and everybody loses. But they would develop some sort of in-house, you know, Sony-owned graphic design company.
Well,
whatever. I mean,
while we're on that subject, that's actually one of the things that I initially thought was like a way out of this. Like, if, you know, the studios wanted to sort of unfuck this problem, was to sort of do that. So I did some research, and it turns out studios are really bad at acquiring visual effects houses.
Shocking.
Specifically, Disney in the past year bought or acquired and then closed Buena Vista Visual Effects, Image Movers, DreamQuest Images, The Secret Lab, and Disney Feature Animation in Orlando. And that was before acquiring Industrial Light and
it
Magic,
reminds me when,
which is just barely profitable as it is.
It reminds me when Jerry Bruckheimer bought that video game studio, which he owned for 6 years, during which they never made a single game. It's like, yes, like some people getting into fields where they don't necessarily know the lay of the land.
I mean, is that just too much, or the too much girth, if you will, under their wing? Like, they just can't manage all these different things, that they need to be their own entities to
girth
have
under
true
their wing.
Of...
I mean, they're
very
capitalism.
Poetic.
I'm a tone poem.
So, like, capitalism is going to find a way. For instance, very recently, Michigan has come under the microscope in this conversation because they shot part of Oz the Great and Powerful in Pontiac under a company called Michigan Motion Picture Studios, which still has debts from Oz the Great and Powerful. And since Michigan offers unlimited subsidies to this production, they had to pull out of the retirement program to pay back this film studio's debt. So public workers in Michigan just lost a couple $1 million to Oz the Great and Powerful as it comes out, because of these state subsidies. So it's possible that something like that could go away as VFX workers simultaneously unionize on or around March 14th, aka now. But I mean, we'll see. Capitalism's going to find a way. We're going to have movies one way or the other.
Should I be boycotting anything? Should I make my Twitter a green blob?
Yeah, please tell me why I should make my Twitter a green blob.
Just to tell the VFX artists that you are aware that they have a problem and that you're on their side and they should get paid for equal work. It's all literally right. The least you could do.
I know that. Well, but like when everyone was doing, I mean, the same thing happened like during the Green Revolution in Iran, and it's so literally the least you can do that it seems empty to me. But that might just be a rationalized.
At the same time, I mean, I think you know, if anybody sees a green clover on something for the Green Revolution, or a green blob,
you raise awareness,
or a green whatever, you know, and ask the question, then you've already done some good. And when you have, you know, the volume of Twitter followers that you do and Cinema Blend and whatnot, that's a lot of people that could be asking questions. So I don't think, you know, while it may be the least you can do, it certainly doesn't mean it's nothing, which is not to say that you should necessarily do it for this particular case. But
What Dave doesn't know is that I took
his grief
on
not being in part of the Arab Spring out on the VFX Union.
I still really regret 2008 or whatever.
Dave, what you don't know is when you made your Twitter handle a green keyframe kind of thing, I keyed it out and I put a wiener in there. So that was bad move because I know special effects.
That is how visual effects come back.
Boom.
Yes. Okay, that does it for this week's Operation Kino. We'll be back on Friday with our review of Sally Potter. Who directed it? No, yes, Sally Potter.
Yes, Sally Potter.
Oh my God, I'm second guessing myself. We'll be back on Friday with our review of Sally Potter's Ginger and Rosa, which is now out in theaters after some qualifying releases last fall. Anyway, in the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I'm the movies editor of Hollywood.com. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And remember to answer our lightning round question by @messaging us @opkino on Twitter.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor of film.com. You can find me on Twitter @DavidEhrlich and @filmdotcom. And also, if you have any thoughts about the show, and how could you not, feel free to go on our iTunes page and leave us a review. We always appreciate it, especially if you're nice and don't say that. I have no way to end the sentence. Next.
Okay. I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell that first part D-A-7-E. I'm probably he of the internet at this point, so check me out at twitter.com/DA7E and at DA7E.com, or see all of us on Facebook at facebook.com/OPKINO.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me here at Cinema Blend or on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-A-C-H. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. We have enjoyed the voicemails we've heard so far at 914-410-6450.
If he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of glass. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of glass. If he stays, pieces of love. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of light.